This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll talk to the Bruce Museum's curator of science about a new exhibit which explores the wildlife of Madagascar. But first, listen closely to the music of Thomas Mpfumo and you'll hear the pulse of Zimbabwe. It's a sound unlike any other. It's driven by decades of brutality and anti-colonial struggles. Today we're talking about a new book that looks at how Mpfumo's songs became the voice of an entire nation. You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Find us online at wnpr.org/where we live and also on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. In studio with us is Banning Air, who's senior editor and producer of Afropop Worldwide and author of this new book, Lion Songs, Thomas Mpfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. Banning, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here, John.
Tell us about this song.
Okay, this song, it's called Ngoma Yarira, which means the drums are playing, the drums are sounding. And it's about 1974, which is the time when the liberation war in Zimbabwe is really starting to heat up, kind of low-level guerrilla warfare around the country to overthrow the white Rhodesian regime of that time. And this song is a real turning point for Mpfumo because up to this point he'd been singing rock and roll and Afro rock and covering Elvis and Otis Redding and things like that. And he came to see that this was kind of corrupt, you know, that it was all part of the Rhodesian, you know, sort of indoctrination and brainwashing where you just pay attention to foreign music and degrade your own culture. So in this song he's taking the harmony and melody of a traditional mbira song, mbira being the sort of handheld metal pronged instrument, sometimes called a thumb piano, that was used in a religious practice, like spirit possession ceremony, is something very stigmatized by Rhodesian missionaries and education system. And so he took it and he kind of did it as an experiment. This song, the great story about this song, Ngoma Yarira, is that he didn't know it was going to be a hit. It was one of a bunch of songs that this band that he had at the time, which was called the Hallelujah Chicken Run Band.
Great name for a band.
Yeah, really good. Love that. And, you know, they played up in a mine. They played for the miners. They were kind of owned by a mining company at the time. And he didn't know this was going to be the hit. But as he always says, the people chose Ngoma Yarira. That was the song that sold. And it was kind of a cue to him that this notion he had of trying to sort of bring the tradition into his popular music was the right way to go, and it sort of determines his whole path after that.
And throughout the course of our program, you'll hear that sound a lot, the sound of a guitar plucking out the sound of the mbira, which is something that hadn't really been done, hadn't really been popularized in that way. There was traditional music, and as you said, rock bands like he was in that played essentially Western music, and the fusing of these two things, it started something new.
It did. I mean, there are technically other examples of earlier bands, you know, doing what they call traditional adaptations. But the thing that's different about Thomas is that once he got this idea, he really let it define him. And a lot of mbira, but not just mbira, other kinds of traditional music too. I mean, he saw the whole, you know, he's often portrayed as a political singer, you know, someone who has taken these bold political stands, and it's true. But I always say that in a way his more consistent and somehow deeper message was more about culture. It's more about, you know, we were taught to be ashamed of our culture and we need to throw that off. And that's something, that's a dynamic that's still going on in Zimbabwe. That message is still relevant because the intensity of the Rhodesian kind of mindset, you know, where they wanted to live in Rhodesia. They didn't just want to get cheap labor or resources. They wanted to live there. So that meant they had to really work with the population, make them be the kind of population that these, you know, British expatriates, Rhodesians who had become Africans wanted, you know, a subservient population. So that meant they had to really play with their minds. They had to really, like, indoctrinate them and make them be good British people. And part of that was making them be ashamed of their own culture. And that really is the thing that Mpfumo has championed throughout his career.
As we talk about the life and the story of Thomas Mpfumo, we'll be hearing some more music as Banning Air joins us to talk about his new book, Lion Song. So tell us about the Rhodesia that he was born into, that he grew up in. What was it like? What was his early life like?
Well, his experience was very interesting because he was born out of wedlock, and his father didn't have enough money to pay the bride price, Lobola. So his mother sent him out of the city, Salisbury, which is now Harare, to live with her parents in basically the what they called the communal land. So he basically grew up on a farm where there was no radio, there was no real contact with with the whole sort of technological society around him. And he was pretty he was removed from the politics. He was removed from popular music. For the first 10 years, he was a herd boy. He'd go to school, but he'd have to get up really early in the morning to do chores, go out and, you know, take care of the cattle and whatever dirty chores, as he put it, they had to do. You know, he had to work very hard as a kid. But this 10-year experience made him love the land. It put him in touch with traditional music because he heard mbira being played in traditional ceremonies. Now, he as a kid wasn't allowed to actually go to those ceremonies, but he could hear the music from outside, and it really affected him. He has this very deep, you know, deeply ingrained love of traditional music and traditional culture, even though from the age of 10, when he moved to the city, at that point, he becomes a real urban kid. You know, it's like he's sitting by the radio learning all these Western pop songs, how to sing them. You know, he's fascinated by jazz music and by, you know, all these other passions come in. Golf. He was a golf caddy for a while. He used to skip school to go be a golf caddy.
Yeah, he even talks about maybe being able to be a great golfer someday, which is an amazing thing I never would have thought.
I know. He's full of wonderful contradictions. He's a remarkable person. But this duality, this shift from this very intense rural childhood to this very intense urban, and of course, by the time he moves to Harare, Salisbury at the time, the whole nationalist struggle is heating up. So he really experiences that transition, you know. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the nationalist struggle is that because the Rhodesians had this idea of creating this whole sort of African society of their own vision, they did educate people very well. And a lot of the leaders of the nationalist struggle were highly educated people. And they looked for all these ways to manipulate the larger population in order to get them on board. So it's a very interesting sort of transition from a high-minded, intellectual kind of movement to an increasingly violent guerrilla war. And, you know, Mapfumo was right in the middle of the urban aspect of that in the townships of Salisbury, first Mabvuku and then Mbare, which is still the biggest sort of township, more of a ghetto now these days in Harare.
We're talking with Banning Air, whose new book is Lion Songs, Thomas Mapfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. It's about a musician who is, of course, revered in this country and is a part of so many big political changes there, now lives in exile away from Zimbabwe. We'll talk more about his more modern music in a little bit. But as we head back to the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, as this nationalist movement was heating up, his new band, the Acid Band, and we'll hear some music that it really gets at some of the politics that we're talking about here. What's he singing about here, Banning?
Okay, yeah, this is a great song. This song is called Pamro Mochete, which means it's merely talk. This is probably about 1977. And Ian Smith, the white president of Rhodesia, had declared there would never be black rule in Rhodesia in 1,000 years. Pamro Mochete. That's what he's saying back to him. You're just talking. That's talk.
It's only talk, yeah.
It's only talk. and he was right, because literally months later, Smith had to do an about-face and say, okay, we're going to have majority rule and we're going to have elections. And, you know, you can just hear in that song the kind of, first of all, this rebellious feist. There's kind of a Bob Dylan edge to it, you know, but also it's got this moral authority, you know. I mean, the way he sings is so confident, it's cocky, you know, and it really, really hit a chord with people. That was one of the songs that made the Acid Band hugely in demand.
But that's what's so interesting about this, too. We're not talking about underground music that is sort of part of a pulse of the people, but it's actually really, really popular chart-topping music at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Although it was still kind of a novelty in that way because most of the chart-topping music wasn't really like that at all. so it was kind of a new thing, but it really caught on in the townships. And actually, chart-topping is a little misleading because it did get radio play. I mean, eventually his songs were getting banned. This is around the time his songs are starting to get banned. But what the record company did is they would hire these sort of mobile disco trucks that would just go through the townships blasting the music and selling records right out of the truck, you know. And these records got around. I mean, they got up to England, they got to Mozambique and Zambia, where the guerrilla fighters had their bases, you know. And Mapfumo became like a real sort of folk hero to the people who were actually doing the fighting. And this is what made him, you know, a real national figure at this time. Although, you know, it's funny because there are all these different sort of pockets of understanding and of reality. I mean, even the fact that it took the censors so long to understand what was happening in these songs to actually get around to banning them. They didn't catch it right away, you know. And there's all these sort of like layers of obfuscation, you know. Obviously the people who would be monitoring these songs are themselves Shona speaking people. And, you know, there's a sense that some of them didn't really want to tweak their sort of supervisors to what was going on until they absolutely had to. So this may have slowed the process down a little too, but sort of hard to get to the bottom of that all these years later. But clearly the songs got out and around. They were not effectively suppressed, even when they were being banned on the radio.
And let's hear another song from this time period. Again, that beautiful guitar sound, but also a song about hardship.
Yeah, hardship in the rural areas. Now, this one, you know, I mean, it's just talking about how tough it is. He's thinking about the people back home who are being, you know, I mean, back home by being like on the farm where he grew up, who are being traumatized by the war because of all the privations that are coming about. And he's not saying anything that's directly political, but he's just describing this situation within this kind of like passionate way that everyone knows he's talking about the war, even though he's not saying anything about the war. And also that song is very – that's another sort of evolution in his adaptation of Mbira music. It's – you know, I don't know if you notice this as it goes, but it's kind of in two time signatures at the same time. It's sort of in 3-4 and in 4-4 at the same time, which is one of the characteristics of Mbira music. And he's really – the way that song is arranged, you really hear it. The drums are hitting one rhythm and the guitar's in a different rhythm, and they're kind of locked in this hypnotic relationship, which also – as I was saying before, is communicating a cultural message that is as powerful as the political message, I think.
Mm. I want to, before our break, actually get to the next phase of the history of Zimbabwe, of course, when it becomes Zimbabwe and liberation comes. And you have a scene in here at the time of the liberation in 1980 or so. Bob Marley comes to play.
Right.
And it's interesting because I think a lot of people who read this book might immediately think of someone who is a political leader and a musician like Bob Marley. Obviously, this is something that you've probably been asked before and you've thought a lot about. In terms of Thomas Mapfumo and Marley, where are the similarities? What are the differences in the two stories and the way they impacted the lives of the people that they touched so much?
Well, it's very interesting because the two were almost the same age at that point.
Yeah.
Thomas he was still in many ways an underground sensation, even though he's getting radio play and he's popular with Africans. You know, nobody outside Zimbabwe except for expat communities in London know about him. And Bob Marley is at roughly the same age, at the absolute height of his fame. I mean, he's a worldwide phenomenon. And he's making this trip back. He's making this trip to Africa. And I mean, literally, he's only about a year from his death. He's already got the problem in his toe that becomes cancerous that ultimately kills him. And it's just interesting that he's at this like this pinnacle just about to be the end, and Thomas is really just getting going in terms of his career. I mean, it's too bad the guys didn't actually get to sort of meet and talk. Thomas was on a bit on the outs with the incoming Zimbabwean regime at that time, because he had been, it's a long story, but he had been manipulated in the final months of the war. He was detained and arrested and made to sing at a rally of a kind of accommodationist leader that Smith had tried to set up as a kind of halfway measure towards independence. And because Thomas became sort of tainted with that experience, there was a lot of mistrust. And so at the independence ceremony where Marley played and all these historic events happened, it's, you know, it's a great moment in African history. Mapfumo and his band, he always tells his story, they'd showed up at 8 p.m. and they kept being kept off. You know, all these other bands were playing and things were happening, and they weren't actually brought on until literally just before sunrise. And, you know, every important Jack and Jill, as Tom puts it, had left. and they ended up playing just for, you know, the guerrillas with their AK-47s and the kids who had helped them, like Dancing in the Dust. He always paints this picture of the, you know, the first sunrise in Zimbabwe, and it's just them and the band. And, you know, they were okay with that.
And they were okay with that, but I'm sure that over the years it has stuck with him that at the time of this historic liberation, the Mugabe regime comes into play, and we'll be talking in a bit about what has happened with Robert Mugabe since. But essentially, it's almost as though this man who helped to bring about this revolution in part through his music wasn't allowed to be part of it. Has that stuck with him throughout the years?
Well, you know, I remember asking him many years later what the most difficult time of his career was, and he, without missing a beat, said it was the period right after independence when they had to kind of win back their credibility. So it was not so much this moment. I mean, he's still, you know, you can hear the emotion in his voice when he describes that experience. But he always ends on this positive note of just remembering how powerful that actual performance was. But the period after that, he had to win back his credibility, and that was hard. People weren't coming to the shows. You know, there was a lot of stuff being said, and so he had to, you know, kind of remake himself, and that was hard for him. He still says it was the hardest thing of all.
As we head to a break, we're going to hear a song called The Lion, and this is a song from 1981, so this is after the rise of Zimbabwe. Can you just tell us about the song, Banning, as we head
to break? Sure. It was recorded then, but it was probably played earlier. Shumba is the lion. It's the lion in the bush, and the lion is kind of a symbol for the guerrilla fighters. It's kind of this is almost coming out at this time, it's a nostalgic memory of the guerrilla fighters and what they went through and what they, you know, sacrificed. And it's an absolutely beautiful, it's a refinement of the whole Mbira guitar thing. Just listen to it.
We're talking about the music of Thomas Mapfumo and listening to some of this music with Banning Air, whose new book is called Lion Songs, Thomas Mapfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. We'll be talking more about this history and this musician coming up after this break, and also be joined by a young Zimbabwean artist. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
I want to tell you something about our president. In the eyes of other people, he's a hero. Even with me, I look at him as a hero. he actually gave the African the freedom he was looking for. But at the same time, when you are a president, everyone is looking at you as the only father. Even those who don't like you, they are still your children. So if you take sides, you don't hold your position as a president of a nation. If there's any violence going on between the two political parties, you are there to step in and say, I don't want this nonsense in my country. I don't care whether you are ZANU-PF or you are MDC. I just want to see my people living in peace. And that's what a good president does.
That was Thomas Mpfumo reflecting on the Robert Mugabe regime in a 2009 interview with our guest, Banning Air. Banning Air's new book is Lion Songs, Thomas Mpfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. Banning Air is also the senior editor and producer of Afropop Worldwide, and they've produced a series of documentary pieces about Thomas Mpfumo's life. So he's talking there about Mugabe, and we got up in the first segment to the part where Zimbabwe becomes a free nation and Robert Mugabe is seen as a hero. And now this musician is put in a position of having to comment on, through music, this regime, which, again, over the course of the last several decades, we've seen what has happened, frankly. So talk about that. Talk about how he played into this Mugabe regime and what he was trying to say with his music at the time, Banning.
Okay, so yeah, a lot of water under the bridge between Shumba and the lion fighting in the bush and 2009 with this speech we just heard.
Yeah.
Basically, it was, you know, people will draw the line at different points, but during the 1980s, I mean, within the first decade of the liberation, you know, of Zimbabwe and the Mugabe regime, Thomas began to have doubts. He saw things that were promised that weren't being delivered on. And then a really critical moment comes. Perhaps we'll hear the song in 1988 when there is a huge corruption scandal is revealed, where ministers are buying BMWs and selling them on the black market. And Thomas sings this song, Corruption, that really points an accusatory finger at the regime that he's been so associated with. This is a very brave thing that he did at this time. I mean, in some ways, it was a lot braver than what he did in the 70s.
Yeah, these aren't hidden lyrics. These aren't sort of hinting at anything. This is really saying out loud to this regime corruption.
Yeah, 8 years of freedom.
And so he's singing this. It also strikes me, too, that of all the music that we've heard, this doesn't sound like him fusing traditional Zimbabwean Shona music. This sounds like a reggae song or a song that Bob Marley would sing. This is a popular song.
Sure. And it's important to note that even though we've been listening to these very traditionally focused songs, he was always doing that. I mean, even from before, you know, I mean, he has rock and roll songs. He has jazzy songs. He has songs that, you know, draw on sort of African jazz and reggae and, you know, funk. I mean, he's a very diverse artist. I mean, if you look at the whole canon of his songs, probably only about 30-40% of them are really based on roots tradition stuff. I mean, so it's important. That's the stuff he's best known for.
Yeah.
And it is really noteworthy. And to me, a lot of it is the stuff that really stands up. But a song like Corruption, I mean, right, it has nothing to do with that. And yet, that was the biggest selling song he had made since independence. This song, I mean, once again, he showed this ability to just have the right song at the right moment, you know. And this song, oh, my God, it was just huge. And then there was this whole thing where, you know, the radio stations were told not to play it, and then they were the people said, oh, they're banning the song. So then the radio stations were told to play it so that they wouldn't be accused of banning. It was just put everyone in such an awkward position to have him do such a in-your-face, bold, you know, kind of turnabout.
And aside from just the censors not knowing sure what to do with it, what does Robert Mugabe say? I mean, what is the reaction, not just to this song, but of this tone of his music at this time?
Well, it's ambiguous and it's murky, and it unfolds over the next decade, really, because at this point, from this point on, everyone knows that, you know, just the way they knew in the 70s that he was a political singer singing against the regime, that he's not at this point calling for Mugabe to step down or be defeated. But he's just pointing out the shortcomings of you haven't met your promises. You're eating up all this money. You're surrounding yourselves with all this corruption. This is not what we fought for, you know. He's saying stuff like that, and in many ways, in songs that come about. But and meanwhile, the economy. I mean, when I went to live in Zimbabwe for the longest research period I did for this book, it's 1997 and 98, so it's almost 10 years after this song. And this is a time when Mugabe is getting heavy pressure from war veterans, some of whom aren't really war veterans; they're too young to have fought in the war. But there's a whole sort of movement of war veterans, some of whom are actual war veterans, some aren't, but doesn't matter. The point is that they're being organized by a sort of rogue element, and they're starting to sort of take matters into their own hands, because one of the big promises of the revolution was that there would be land redistribution, because the great crime of Rhodesia was to steal all this prime land and force people to live on you know, much less good land. And so all this land is in the control of huge white corporate farms. And Mugabe has never really – it's a little complicated political story. It has to do with England and Tony Blair not totally following through on things that Margaret Thatcher had promised and various stuff. You know, lots of people have their spin on it. But the point of the matter is there really hadn't been much land distribution by that time. So so these gangs of war vets start taking matters into their own hands, and Mugabe realizes that he has to be on their side. So he gets behind them and starts basically being their cheerleader as they march onto farms and put all these people out of work and burn and destroy things. And the economy just – I mean, during the time I lived there in 1997 and 98, the Zimbabwe dollar was just plunging. And it was having all kinds of terrible effects that sort of inflation has. And there started to be food riots and things were really coming unraveled. And Thomas is singing about this and pointing these things out, he begins to become seen as more of a real problem, and they start harassing him in various ways. And this is what leads him to go into first to move his family to the United States in 2000, and then he's going back and forth. And by the time you get to 2004, he really doesn't feel like he can go back there at all. And he applies for political asylum, and he's been here ever since. He hasn't been to Zimbabwe since April of 2004.
We're talking with Banning Air from Afropop Worldwide about his new book, Lion Songs, Thomas Mapfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. I want to bring into the conversation Rebecca Aston, who's a digital artist from Zimbabwe who graduated from Yale University. We join her today on the phone from New York City. And Rebecca, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Very nice to be a part of this conversation.
You've been listening to some of the conversation. We've essentially gotten up to more or less modern day Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe that you grew up in, and you grew up as a family of one of these white farmers. Can you tell me about growing up in Zimbabwe at the time that we've been just speaking about?
Correct. Yeah, I was born in 1990, and my father was a white farmer, and he lost his farm during the land reclamation in about 2002. So, yeah, the Zimbabwe I know was one that was, firstly, Zimbabwe and not Rhodesia. And so I went to schools that were not segregated. But, yes, sort of the economic situation and political situation when I was young was very difficult. And we've just heard about some of those things as talked about by Banning. If there's anything else you'd like to ask.
Well, and as you made your way to the United States and you work here now, how do you reflect on your country, which of course I'm sure you love and Thomas Mafumo loves, but yet has had so many struggles and problems over the year. How do you view Zimbabwe from afar now?
Yes, coming to Zimbabwe, to America for college, when I went to Yale, it was a sort of very mind-opening moment for me, being able to sort of step outside of the country and look at the longer history of the place, and to sort of be able to have free dialogue about the colonial history and both the sort of current political situation that was in Zimbabwe. Because on the ground, when I was younger, those sorts of conversations didn't always happen within classrooms, partly because it was a difficult set of conversations to be having, especially with both Shona and white Zimbabwean and Indibela people within those classrooms. Also, another problem was the fact that we mostly learned English syllabi, and so learning African history in general was not something that we did very often. So coming to America was a very, very growing and good moment for me.
How do you see your art today reflecting your homeland?
For me, my art is something that is very personal. I hesitate to speak for an entire nation and to speak for anyone beyond myself. So a lot of my work is very personal, and nonetheless, it does reflect my history in Zimbabwe. A lot of it is concerned with territorial space or imagined space, and sort of for me it's about being able to claim my memories in a positive way, and my nationality as a Zimbabwean in a positive way, without sort of, while at the same time shedding a lot of old British ideas about inheritance and land, etc. So for me it's a very personal thing.
It's interesting, Banning, because what Rebecca's talking about actually seems to echo a lot of what you write about with Thomas Mafumo, this idea of claiming the memories of a place in a positive way, of trying to bring some positive to a place that has seen so much struggle. Of course, he goes through the struggle for independence and then comes out on the other side as essentially a man who can't live in the place that he wants to be because of the terrible, terrible politics.
Yeah, it's kind of tragic. I mean, he is dying to go home. He so wants to go home, and especially to perform, because obviously there's tremendous hunger of you know, the people who remember to hear him, and it just keeps getting sort of interfered with. Every time he thinks he has an arrangement to go home, something goes wrong. The government's trying to manipulate it in some way. I mean, it's interesting. Mugabe himself just this year has made some sort of mildly self-critical comments about the way the whole land thing unfolded, that, you know, maybe they gave people farms that were a little too big for them to manage. I mean, it's sort of interesting that he's willing to critique himself at all, because he's been so hardcore and so defiant and so unwilling to concede any fault.
Which is, of course, one of the big controversies at the time, that indeed the food production of that country just plummeted because people took over these farms that didn't necessarily know how to run them at the size they were.
There's a song that Thomas recorded in 2001, right at the height of this, and it's called Mari Manzara, and he was basically saying, "You have harvested hunger," and you know, it kind of is a counterpart to a song he sang much earlier, where he was talking about how, you know, you need to really study agriculture, and you know, you said that you knew what you were doing, but you haven't done this land reform, and now here he is. Okay, now you're doing it, and you're doing it in this way where you're just making everybody hungry, and it's hard to underestimate how kind of courageous it was for him to say that at that time, because there was so much pressure to be sort of revolutionarily correct and to back Mugabe, you know, and he just put it right out there. No, this is not right. This is not the way to do it. Yeah. note there. You hear now the mature sound of the Blacks Unlimited with this rich mbiras, and guitar is much more in the background. It's really bringing forward the traditional instruments.
Rebecca, before I let you go, your family is still living in Zimbabwe. Are they farming there now?
My mother is still living in Zimbabwe, and my father is farming in Zambia now.
And do you plan on going back home soon? Do you go back often?
I don't go back that often at the moment. I do plan to return to Zimbabwe, but for at least a year I'll be staying in America. But yes, it's something that I think about continuously, how to sort of be in contact with my country and sort of be responsible and sort of go back and, you know, contribute.
Rebecca Aston is a digital artist who grew up in Zimbabwe. She went to Yale University. She's now in the United States. And thank you, Rebecca, so much for spending some time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And you will also have information about her work at WNPR.org/where we live. You can also learn more about Banning Air's book, Lion Songs, Thomas Mapfumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe, by visiting his website. It's Banning Air. That's BanningEyre.com. Banning, thanks for bringing this history to us, and thank you for the book, and thanks most of all for all the great music, as you always bring.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate being on the show again.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about a new exhibit at the Bruce Museum that takes a look at the long, long history of a place that Banning has also spent quite a bit of time, Madagascar. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, is it time to rethink how we train our police force? We'll take a closer look at police training guidelines and find out what's working and what isn't. We'll also talk to the Washington Post's Emily Badger about her thought-provoking account of how Baltimore became Baltimore. See what we can learn about our cities here. You can join us coming up on Monday's Where We Live. Today, we're exploring the culture and history of two African countries. A bit earlier, we heard the music of Zimbabwean singer-songwriter Thomas Mapfumo in a new book called Lion Songs. Now we're moving to the island nation of Madagascar. Dr. Daniel Sepka is the curator of Madagascar Ghosts of the Past, a new exhibit at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. He joins us now from our New Haven studios. And Dr. Sepka, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here.
And if you have questions about science and Madagascar history, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I was asking my producer, Lydia, but what were we going to talk about in this exhibit? She goes, oh, just about 120 million years of history. No big deal, right? So tell us about this exhibit. How did this come to be?
So in this exhibition, we wanted to tell the story of the natural history of Madagascar. And as you said, that entails a very long period of time. For 88 million years, Madagascar has been separate from all other major land masses. And actually, the last other part of the world it was in contact with was not Africa, but India, which later on crashed into Asia, an event that's still occurring today. And so over that 88 million years, a large variety of plant and animal species have evolved and in some cases gone extinct. And we'd like to present a sampling of those in the exhibition.
So, of course, this amazing history of the place, the fact that it has been separated, makes for a number of different species. Maybe you can give us a sense of just how different the life has been on Madagascar than it has been in neighboring Africa or maybe even in India, which it was once part of.
We have several phases of the natural history. When Madagascar first becomes an island, it's kind of pre-stocked with many interesting animals, and these are species that would be very unfamiliar to us today. Some dinosaurs, for example, and some very bizarre relatives of crocodiles and alligators. And one of my favorite and one that's featured in the exhibition is Cimasuchus. This is a tiny pug-sized crocodile that had small leaf-shaped teeth, and it was actually a vegetarian terrestrial relative of modern crocodiles, so one of the most unusual animals that ever lived.
Hmm. Well, what are some other unusual animals that you might find there that you wouldn't find anyplace else? And maybe even some animals that were indeed on the island many, many millions of years ago and we wouldn't find there today.
So if we were to go to Madagascar today, we'd find over 10,000 species that are not known naturally anywhere on Earth. These are endemic species, and so these are plant animals. Lemurs are perhaps the flagship group of Madagascar. These are a group of primates. They're related to apes and monkeys and to ourselves, but they're a deeper branch in the primate family tree. And so perhaps the most familiar of these would probably be the ring-tailed lemur with its bright white and black striped tail. It is one of more than 100 types of lemurs that live in Madagascar today, and there are many others that are only known from fossils.
What has been some of the impact of humans on the island? Obviously, wherever we go, humans do tend to cause some destruction to the native species there. Has that been more pronounced on a closed system like Madagascar?
One of the things that we've learned from the fossil record, from sub-fossils, these are remains of extinct organisms that are, in some cases, only a few hundred years old, is that humans had a profound impact on the larger animal species that were living in Madagascar when they first arrived, roughly 1,000 years ago. And so there are many, for example, giant lemur species, all of which are wiped out today. We had a koala lemur. This was a lemur that was basically the size of a gorilla. And despite its kind of ferocious appearance of the skull, it actually was a leaf-eating species. We had the elephant bird, the largest bird ever to have lived, standing 10 feet tall. This was an enormous flightless bird, also wiped out in the last few centuries. Pygmy hippopotami as well, three different species of tiny hippos were wiped out. And so many, many large species were driven to extinction by a combination of factors. This included direct hunting, but also modification of the landscape. So burning of forests, for example, and kind of removing the environments that they needed to survive.
And does the island today still suffer from some of the problems of poaching and deforestation that has plagued parts of mainland Africa over the many decades and centuries now?
There are certainly some severe conservation concerns. And so there are many national park systems which are wonderful in terms of trying to conserve these species and protect the environments they live in. But two of the big threats that are facing is particularly forest species, like many of the lemurs, are slash and burn agriculture, a practice known as tabby in Madagascar, where people will burn the forest so they can plant that land for agricultural crops. And that, of course, removes the places where these animals live. In many cases, the fires kind of spread into areas they weren't originally intended to go. And another very severe threat is the harvesting of exotic woods for things like furniture or musical instruments. So rosewood in particular is highly commercially valuable. But taking those trees out of the forest directly and indirectly really impacts these species. So in some cases, even if you're only after that one type of tree, the roads need to be built for the logging. There's bushmeat poaching. There's all types of associated effects. And so these are really threatening the places where these animals and plants live.
And it sounds like the conservation enforcement there is not what it could be or should be to protect the plants and animals that are so delicate.
So it's wonderful that the government is committed to new natural parks or national parks, and that's very important. But there's always the kind of paradigm where something could be protected on paper, no poaching, no logging, but the enforcement is a whole other issue. So whether there's the resources to kind of patrol the parks and actually keep people from getting in there and taking out these rosewood trees, or even hunting some of the species, in some cases even collecting animals for the pet trade.
Mm. But before we run out of time, though, I have to ask you about one of your favorite things in this exhibit. I understand that you are particularly attached to an elephant bird egg that you have. Maybe you can describe what this thing is, first of all, and why you find it so fascinating.
Certainly. The elephant bird is a remarkable species. Its scientific name is Epiornis maximus, and it was the largest bird ever to have lived. It arrived in Madagascar as a flying or volant bird sometime in the deep past, and over many, many generations, this particular lineage lost the ability to fly but gained tremendous stature. And so the largest individual stood roughly 10 feet in height and weighed around 1,000 pounds, and they laid the largest eggs that are known on Earth. And so these eggs would hold the equivalent of 150 chicken eggs in terms of the yolk volume.
150 chicken eggs. So I'm just trying to get my brain around this. A 10-foot-tall bird that lays an egg that's probably the size of, I don't know what, a large watermelon or bigger?
It's quite a bit larger than a football.
Okay, so you have one of these eggs?
We have on display an egg, and also I think one of the most unique objects in the exhibition, a 3D printout of the embryo of an elephant bird. And so when I was a graduate student, I shared an office with a scientist named Amy Balanoff, who's today at Stony Brook University. And she actually reconstructed the embryo of one of these birds. She CT scanned an egg. They would not let her open it, of course, because that would damage it. And inside were the tiny bones of an unhatched embryo of the species. And so she painstakingly put those back together. And we actually printed it out so that we can display it in the exhibition and show people how that technology can be used to look inside fossils. And it has so many different applications. And so it's an example of how we can study really ancient fossils with modern technology.
That's so fascinating. So, what do you hope people take away from an exhibition like this? Because there are so many historical exhibitions of fossils that take us back in time, but a lot of them seem to be out of place. Like the great dinosaur fossils that I grew up with at the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh, I don't exactly remember where they came from. But the fact that you're being very place specific about the history of Madagascar, I think maybe can help people tell a little story of a place they might never go.
Right. I think that one of the important messages is the isolation breeds uniqueness. So the reason we have so many different species that are endemic to the island is because the closest major landmass to get to Africa, it's 250 miles at the shortest point across the Mozambique Channel. And so these species have had millions of years to go on their own evolutionary pathways, and they've evolved to just wondrous forms. The nocturnal eye-eye, which is a primate that actually forages using its finger to probe grubs out of bamboo and other trees. We have the adorable tenrecs. They're kind of little hedgehog mimics that are actually more closely related to African elephants than they are to European hedgehogs. And we have many species that are just critical to human health. For example, the Madagascar periwinkle is a very unassuming, scrubby little plant with a tiny pink or white flower. And this species has yielded chemical compounds that have been used to treat Hodgkin's disease and leukemia. And so it's improved the lives of thousands of people. We love these species for their aesthetic value and their value to the ecosystem, but we'd like people to come away realizing that these animals and plants can really be important to our own lives as well. And perhaps if we don't conserve these forest areas, the next Madagascar periwinkle will be wiped out before we ever find out its use.
So if your only exposure to Madagascar is the animated movies, maybe you might want to check out Madagascar Ghosts of the Past. It's on view at the Bruce Museum now through November 8th. More information at brucemuseum.org. Dr. Daniel Sepka is the curator of science at the Bruce Museum. Thank you so much for bringing us these stories. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
As we head out to the end of our program, we're actually going to bring you some music that our friend Banning Air brought last time he was here. It's a Malagasy tune from a whole study that he did of the music of Madagascar. Of course, the music that we were talking about earlier, you can learn more about in his book, Lion Songs, Thomas Mpofumo and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. You can visit his website, banningair.com. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Our intern is Kelsey Bissell. Continue this conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.